following is a presentation of Emmanuel Covenant Church, located in South Surrey, British Columbia. To learn more, please visit us online at emmanuelcovenant.ca.
First off, I just want to say thank you very much personally for all your prayers and support. I was supposed to speak a while ago, as was mentioned, and then I got pretty sick. It was a fluke thing, and I was kind of wiped out for a month, but I know that you guys were praying for me as well as a lot of other churches. I was just back in Chicago for a homecoming and was running into all kinds of people from all sorts of Covenant churches all over North America that were asking me how I was doing and how I was feeling, and we were praying for you. And that was just really special, and it was very humbling, and I know you were part of that, so thank you very much. I'm also honored to be here and speak. My grandfather spoke here quite regularly, and my father has spoke here as well, and so now I feel honored to speak. And I don't know if we're getting better as the generations go, but we're definitely getting shorter, so that's good. That's good for you. So I'll keep it short. So originally, when Eric asked me to come speak, it was part of a Micah 6:8 series where there was five speakers, same passage, five different ways, something like that, which was great. So my background and my work, I work now for a technology company, and we build products and services for the charitable sector, so nonprofits as well as donors, and so we try to make it easier for charitable giving to be a part of everyday life. That's kind of what we're trying to achieve. But my background is more in nonprofit administration, and in particular international development, and in particular kind of social justice issues. So Micah 6:8 was great for me, who I'm not a preacher, so I could engage with the text and then talk more about things that I knew, kind of international development, nonprofit work, charitable giving, that kind of stuff. And then I got sick, and so now I'm here talking about James, and Eric said, oh, you'll be speaking on James 3. And so I was like, okay, you know, James has been a very powerful book for me personally in my own faith journey. So I said, this will be fine. And I pulled up James 3 on the train. It's been a while, admittedly, since I had read through James. And so the very first verse that I pulled up goes like this. Not many of you should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. And I was thinking, what did I do to Eric? I thought we were friends, you know, we go to dinner. I was like, was it fantasy football? Did I do a trade? Or, you know, what did I do wrong to deserve this, Eric? But the more you get into the passage, the more it fits with the theme that you've been going on, and living an authentic faith. And James 3 focuses more specifically on how we use our words, but that's just an action, a specific action that he focuses on within this chapter. So I'll tie in some of my, international development, nonprofit work in an analogy. We'll go through the text. I'll be using the Message version. If you want to pull it up, we'll read through the whole thing, and we'll go from there. So a quick recap, as far as I understand where you're at from listening to the podcasts online. James, the author, more than likely is the younger half-brother of Jesus. He wrote this book not to one particular group or one particular church, but kind of to the 12 tribes spread throughout the nations. It's kind of a general message. James has a very pastoral tone. He wants to care for the flock. The focus is living authentically. And more than likely, he was trying to combat a sense of new believers that were very much on the, saved by faith and faith alone, so much so that they were just kind of, my job's done, and would keep going about their business. And so James is kind of combating that type of belief, saying, if faith is real, if faith is true, if faith is really meaningful, there's a natural outpouring in the form of works, in the form of deeds, in the form of actions. So he's kind of, combating that, or coming in from that perspective. James is very direct in how he talks and how he writes, which is great, and especially in the translation, like the Message, it's very straightforward. So we'll read through it and go from there. But that's kind of where we're at, and James 3 focuses again on words. And so here's the big idea that I want to share with you today and try to cover. Think of yourself as a well. And your words are like the water that comes out of the spout. These words can build up and be nourishing, or they can tear down and cause hurt. And you as a well can't simply will yourself to produce clean water. It's only when we dig deep to find a pure source, be in community with others, and monitor diligently ourselves that we can regularly be overflowing with mercy and blessings. So that's kind of the premise that I'm going, and I'll draw an analogy to how sustainable wells are built in Africa. And, you know, if we're wells here to produce good, kind of how do we go about building wells, say, in Africa in a sustainable way? So that's the main point and where we're headed today. So I'm going to start reading from the message here, starting chapter 3, verse 1. I'll go through and pause it a couple times. Don't be in any rush to become a teacher, my friends. Teaching is highly responsible work. Teachers are held to the strictest standards, and none of us is perfectly qualified. Again, thanks, Eric, for this text. We can get it wrong nearly every time we open our mouths. If you could find someone whose speech was perfectly true, you'd have a perfect person in perfect control of life, of which I am not. A bit in the mouth of a horse controls the whole horse. A small rudder on a huge ship in the hands of a skilled captain sets a course in the face of the strongest winds. A word out of your mouth may seem of no account, but it can accomplish nearly anything or destroy it. It only takes a spark, remember, to set off a forest fire. A careless or wrongly placed word out of your mouth can do that. By our speech, we can ruin the world, turn harmony to chaos, throw mud on a reputation, send the whole world up in smoke, and go up in smoke with it. Smoke right from the pit of hell. So James is pretty straightforward here, with both the power and especially the hurt or the downside or the negative side that we can use with words. When we read passages, or sorry, when I read a passage like this, I think there's a temptation to default to the easiest application to my life. So hearing that, words can be good or bad, and so immediately I think, oh, I shouldn't say bad things or use, you know, bad words or swear words. And that's really how I can, you know, live out this passage. And it's tempting because it's a quick fix, right? You just don't say these words. Make sure you say better words, and, you know, we're good and move on. But it's an extreme disservice to what James is saying, and it's also an extreme disservice to our faith and what we're called to. It's about so much more. And if you think of the times when you personally have been hurt, or when I've been hurt, sometimes swear words are involved, actually. But generally, it's not the main thing. It's just kind of an auxiliary thing. And we carry wounds. I carry a wound from grade 6 from a nickname, a girl that I didn't even like. A girl called me from grade 6. And to this day, I still remember exactly what she said and why she said it. And I've carried that with me. And we have those things. And it's just a word. And these words are so powerful. And on the positive side that James focuses a little bit less on, there's so much that we can do and accomplish with words and with speech. I've been reading these historical fiction books where there's 3 of them in a trilogy, and the first one covers kind of World War I and families, and then World War II, and it's kind of a continuation of the families, and the third book is kind of the Cold War in the 60s and 70s. And I've really enjoyed the books. I just finished number 3. My wife Liz is reading number 3 now. But it covers a lot of the civil rights movement, and I was struck by how much of that movement was derived and powered by words, primarily from Martin Luther King Jr., and we know his famous speech when he was in D.C., you know, I Have a Dream. But there was a series of speeches in little churches in Alabama and in Georgia that spawned that movement and led to all kinds of actions, but it was really words and words from one man that spawned this hugely transformative civil rights movement. That obviously has done a lot of good in our world and continues to go today. So words have this huge potential to do bad, but also to do good. And it's not just the simplistic, you know, do this, don't do that kind of thing. Okay, back to the text, verse 7 here. This is scary. You can tame a tiger, but you can't tame a tongue. It's never been done. The tongue runs wild, a wanton killer. With our tongues, we bless God our Father. With the same tongues, we curse the very men and women he made in his image. Curses and blessings out of the same mouth. Funny tongue-taming story, which I didn't think I would end up saying. We were out for dinner last night with friends, and we were celebrating a wedding of friends who got married out east, and this was the West Coast celebration. And for whatever reason, we started talking about these embarrassing stories. And a friend and colleague of mine was talking about in high school, she had this issue where, like all growing up, she actually couldn't swallow properly. Her tongue wouldn't do the right move. It would go out as opposed to kind of up. And so it was pushing her teeth out constantly. And so dentists kept worrying, you know, if we don't, you know, teach you how to swallow properly, you're going to push your teeth out and we're going to have to do all kinds of surgery. So she kept going to dentists, and eventually it was like a panel of dentists, and they started trying all these different things to actually tame her tongue. They gave her a retainer that had spikes on the inside of it, so that when she started to do what was natural to her, it would spike her tongue, and her tongue would go back. And she would do, she had a spray that she would have to use sometimes, and she was talking about something where she'd like pull up her lip, and eventually she had to see a tongue therapist to teach her how to go about this. So for her, tongue taming is very literal. For us, it's a bit more about our words and what we say. And the main point here is that you can't just do it on your own. You can't just sit down in a room and think and be like, you know what, I'm just really going to be good with my words now and go about your business. Maybe in the short term, you know, maybe for that day, maybe for the morning, maybe for a week if you're really good, but you can't transform the way that you use words, because when you're under stress, something's going to happen that you didn't plan on happening. When you're tired at night, something's going to happen. When your kid's yelling or your spouse is angry, that's when deeper-seated things come out where you can't have that level of control. It doesn't happen. So taming your tongue can't be done by you alone. Okay, going back to the text, verse 10. My friends, this can't go on. A spring doesn't gush fresh water one day and brackish the next, does it? Apple trees don't bear strawberries, do they? Raspberry bushes don't bear apples, do they? You're not going to dip into a polluted mud hole and get a cup of clear, cool water, are you? Do you want to be counted wise to build a reputation for wisdom? Here's what you do. Live well, live wisely, live humbly. It's the way you live, not the way you talk, that counts. Mean-spirited ambition isn't wisdom. Boasting that you are wise isn't wisdom. Twisting the truth to make yourself sound wise isn't wisdom. It's the furthest thing from wisdom. It's animal cunning, devilish conniving. Whenever you're trying to look better than others or get the better of others, things fall apart and everyone ends up at the other's throats. And this is where that visual image of a well really started to come out to me when I was reading this. You know, talking about a spring doesn't gush fresh water one day, brackish the next. You can't go into a mud hole and pull out clear water, can you? And so now I'll start kind of drawing some parallels to international development in my work, which is more based in Africa. That's what I'm more experienced with. So part of the problem with access to clean water in Africa isn't that they don't have a clean water source. It's that it's buried so deep under the ground that they can't access it. So you'll get a lot of hand-dug wells that can go down, you know, maybe 10 feet or 10 meters, and you can get some shallow water, and that's often what happens. But the shallow water is very dangerous because it has a lot of contaminants in it. Things from the soil can get in. You can get a lot of bugs. You can get a lot of other diseases, and it can become muddy very, very quickly. So if you really want to get a really good clean water source, you often have to employ a big rig that can go hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of meters under the ground and to find the actual clean, clean water source. And so by human effort alone, you can only dig so deep to get so clear of water, but to get the real good stuff, you gotta go way deep. And I wanna use that as an analogy for us, where if we really want our words in times of stress, in times of trouble, to be good, to be wise, to be building up and not tearing down, we have to go deeper in our source. We can't just, again, go to ourselves or maybe to someone else. We have to go to a source that's bigger than us, and that only comes through a faith that we have in God and with a relationship with God and in community with others, which is the next point, and working with the Holy Spirit. So if you're tapped into a clean water source, then it's natural for clean water to come out. Then it's natural for good items, for nourishing water to come out, as opposed to kind of muddy water that is found only when digging shallow. So the first part is dig deep. And the other piece of this is it's hard work, right? James talks about living well, living wisely, living humbly. That's hard work. Digging a deep well, that's hard work. But if we really want our actions and our words to be clean and nourishing, it does take some hard work. And it starts by digging deep and tapping into a source bigger than ourselves through our faith in God. All right, back to the text. Verse 17 here. Real wisdom, God's wisdom, begins with a holy life and is characterized by getting along with others. It is gentle and reasonable, overflowing with mercy and blessings, not hot one day and cold the next, not two-faced. You can develop a healthy, robust community that lives right with God and enjoys its results only if you do the hard work of getting along with each other, treating each other with dignity and honor. The modern aid and modern aid in development started roughly about 70 years ago with the Marshall Plan, which was a plan concocted to help rebuild Europe after World War II, after it was destructed. So the U.S. was the leader of this, and they sent about $13 billion in aid to Europe to help really rebuild infrastructure and help get society kind of back on track. And so that was, even though we've been doing, you know, ministry and service on a small scale and missions for years and years and years, this is kind of modern aid. That was the birth of modern aid. So that was the blueprint. And so then when we looked at countries like Africa and we're saying, how can we develop, you know, this continent, we kind of took what we did for the Marshall Plan in Europe and just kind of reapplied it to Africa. A huge difference between Europe and Africa was Europe already had infrastructure. Europe already had fully functioning societies with education and economy before it was destroyed in World War I, whereas a continent like Africa hadn't had a lot of infrastructure, hadn't had a lot of those things. So when we just threw money at the problem, it did nothing. Money was not the solution. There's a Zambian economist who wrote this book called Dead Aid, and it's very critical of what we have done in the past 60, 70 years in aid, saying we basically accomplished nothing in terms of health and life. And you can debate that or not, and I debated a bit, but we haven't been as effective. We sent $1 trillion in 60 years, and we haven't moved the needle nearly as much as you'd like to think that we did. And a big piece of that is we weren't community-based. We said, oh, we did this in Europe. This will work in Africa. Or like, oh, we think that they need this, this, and this. Well, let's just do that. And so what emerges is this concept called asset-based community development, or ABCD. And what it does is it really goes into a community, and before you start saying, here's the solution and all the things that you need, it tries to assess the community what assets they have, what things that they're great at, who's the leaders, what do they actually need. And then based on those assets, you work with the community to actually create something that they can use and have some ownership in. So in the context of wells, in the past, they'd come in and be like, oh, they need water, build a well, move on to the next community, and maybe build another well. But those wells, after they would build, would then get run down, and no one would care for them, and they'd be broken, they wouldn't know how to fix them. So this asset-based or community-based model actually now requires a lot of communities to raise a certain percentage of equity. So they have to, as a community, come up with, say, 10% of the cost of the well, or they have to come up with enough funds to do the geological survey to make sure that they have clean water. And what it does is it starts giving some ownership and accountability to the community who's actually using the well, so that they'll care for it afterwards and they'll make sure people aren't, you know, mistreating the well, because there's some ownership there. And I think the comparable for us is if we're really wells and we should be doing good actions and good words, it's important for us to be in community with one another and have some ownership and accountability with others. I think that's one of the strengths of the church, and our society is hugely individualistic. So the temptation is, you know, tap into my clean water source, which is, you know, relationship with God, and I'm good. Move on with my life. But there's no, you know, horizontal or with community. And it's partly for accountability, and it's partly because that's the life that we're called to. If we just all live with God and that's it, we're all done. Then what are we doing? It has to be with others and in community. And so as we go about our business and thinking about wells, we should have some ownership and accountability with spouses and friends and people in church community. And words can be very symptomatic of things that are deeper. And we should feel comfortable and have that opportunity to work with each other in community to make sure that the words that are coming out of our mouths and the actions that we're doing are clean and nourishing and not damaging and hurting. And then the third piece, so on the international development side, or we're building a well, you know, we've dug deep, we've done the hard work, we have a clean water source, we've worked with the community, we have a nice well that there's ownership and accountability. Now there needs to be some monitoring and evaluation. So if the two biggest problems for a well or a school to be kind of run down, the first is not having community buy-in and ownership, and the second is not following up or having some form of evaluation to know if it's still being used or if it's still working. So what this picture is here, it's Charity Water, which is a international organization that does nothing but water projects. They partnered with Google to create this thing. And what this thing does is they can put it on a well, and at any moment in the world, wherever this well is, this thing will tell you how much water is running through, how fast and how quality the water is. And they can get it kind of on an iPad in New York or Uganda or wherever they may be. And so now they can pull up this dashboard and see how every one of their wells are doing at any given time. And so if, you know, the water pressure starts dropping or the water quality starts dropping, they can go back to the community or go back to the well and figure out, you know, how's it doing? How can we repair it? How can we keep going? And I think the comparable for us, again, if we're wells and we're working community, there's ownership accountability, it's ongoing. Right? It's not just a one-time, oh, remember when we talked about James and we did this thing for a month and, you know, our words were great and our actions, and we lived authentic faith. Well, now it's, you know, January and we're on a different series. No, you know, a life that is really living out an authentic faith is hard, but it's every day, right? It's ongoing. We need to be monitoring and evaluating, particularly with words. I mentioned that it's symptomatic. I know for me personally, when I'm short with my wife, I know that it starts indicating, there may be a problem with my source. I maybe not, you know, be in tune or in touch with my faith as I should be, or in the community that we should be. Or when you talk negatively about a coworker, it's a symptom. It could be saying there's something wrong with the source. And so, you know, James's point isn't that it's just about words. He even talks about, no, it's about living well and living wise and living humbly. But words can be the symptom. We can see it coming out, and it can be an indicator of maybe we're off base in our source just a little bit. So that's the big idea. And I think the hope is that if we can be cognizant and think of ourselves as these wells, and do the hard work and dig deep into a real source that has pure water, live in community with others, have some ownership and accountability with one another, and be monitoring it constantly to make sure that we're doing the right things, we can be overflowing with mercy and blessings. I love that line. And this is an image of, there's a charity water well, right, when they kind of tap and hit that pure water source and just explodes, and they get all the community around and they all celebrate it. And I think this is the image of a real solid life of faith that James talks about, not just in James 3, but the whole book. It's just saying, if faith is real to us and if it means something to us, we are just bursting forth in our words and our actions and in our lives, and it just causes goodness everywhere. And so that's what I want to talk about today in James 3, and I think we're going to sing a song now, but I'll pray while they come up, and thank you for listening. God, we thank you for today, and we thank you for the chance that we have to get together and learn with one another. And we pray that we will tap into you, and you can be our source in our words and in our actions and in our everyday lives, and that we'll live in community with one another and live wise and live humbly. Pray now that you'll continue to bless the rest of today and the rest of our worship together. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Emmanuel Covenant Church, located in South Surrey, British Columbia. To learn more, please visit us online at emmanuelcovenant.ca.